The West, from Testimony, the United States, 1885 to 1915, by Charles Reznikoff. Stagecoaches. The horse was young and not broken to harness. As the man at his head tried to put him to a stagecoach with another horse, he plunged, struck the man down, and trampled him. 2. Of the four horses attached to a stagecoach, one of the leaders was called Bitter Root. Bitter Root was bad about shying and quick to start, wild and tricky in starting like a colt. He was changed around often and worked in different places, and some of the drivers would not have him. While the stagecoach was going along at a moderate speed, they met a man on horseback driving before him a pack animal, loaded with a camping outfit and a buffalo robe. Bitter Root and the other horse in the lead became frightened, but went on, and then stopped, whirled around to the left, breaking the tongue of the stagecoach, and ran. The passengers began jumping from the stage. 3. At a station where the stagecoach had stopped at twilight, the driver saw that there were no lamps on it, and called for two lamps. The superintendent brought them and put them on, but one was out of repair and was not lighted. The road ran through a canyon among the mountains, level with a gully on one side. A rock was a foot or so outside the track of the roadway on the other side, where there was no light from the stagecoach. A wheel struck it, and the stage was thrown over. Fraser had been sitting at one end of a seat, crowded close to the side of the stagecoach by the other passengers on the same seat. When the stage was turning over, the other passengers were thrown upon him, and his arm, that had been resting on the railing, was caught under the stagecoach and broken. Town and Country. 1. The body had been buried face downwards. Only the skeleton was left, and it separated in the handling when dug up. The coat was yellow ducking, lined with a light-colored blanket, overalls of yellow ducking, too, and a patch on the knee, a belt on the skeleton, a knife in the pocket, and a bullet hole in the back of the skull. 2. As Hickey and a friend walked along a narrow street in Los Angeles, Salazar was sitting right in the middle of the sidewalk, and, as Hickey and his friend passed, one of them brushed against Salazar, struck him with his foot on the leg, and knocked Salazar's hat off. Salazar got up from the chair and drew a knife to strike at Hickey's friend, and Hickey struck at Salazar with his fist. Salazar turned on Hickey and chased him down the street and kept stabbing him until Hickey fell. There were two wounds on the fingers of Hickey's right hand, another near the left nipple of his breast, and still another on the same side, just back of the shoulder joint, and out of the wound in the groin, his guts were protruding. 3. Lee had told Peter Wells, for whom he worked, "If I thought the man was hunting us in the chaparral, I'd take a rifle and go down and get him. If you would let me have a rifle, I would put Uzwaffle in a prospector's hole." And Wells had said, "No." Wells asked Lee one morning to go with him to Olita and hunt for a horse that had been tracked to a stable there. Lee urged Wells not to go, because Uzwaffle would be in Olita. It would be going into the enemy's camp. Wells said, "I cannot help that. I am going," and rode off with his son. Wells and his son were at the stable 4 or 5 minutes, and then walked into Main Street. Uzwaffle, with a double-barreled shotgun, was sitting in front of a saloon on the opposite side of the street. He called out, "Stop, you son of a bitch! I've got you where I wanted you." "Hold on," said the elder Wells. "You are accusing me wrongfully." Waffle raised his gun and cocked it. The elder Wells stopped and did not move at all, his hands by his side. "Hold on," he said. "You are too fast. I don't want any of this." I do, Waffle answered. I've been hunting for it. Uz, put down your gun and come to me like a man and we'll settle it.
You are a liar and a son of a bitch,
and Waffle called to a woman across the street.
Take the children out of the way and get out of that window, woman.
And then fired. Wells fell backwards on the porch, shot in the forehead, and Waffle stepped into the saloon, but stepped out again at once and started down the street, the gun in his hand. 4. Charlie Blue, acting as deputy sheriff, arrested someone known about town as Gunnysack Joe, upon suspicion that he, with others, had stolen a number of horses. Blue said that Gunnysack Joe, when arrested, told him that those having charge of the horses were camped about 4 miles from town, and Blue summoned a number of citizens as a posse to help arrest them and reclaim the horses. Gunnysack Joe was put in a buggy to guide them to the camp, and Blue rode on ahead to find it. He came back and said there was no camp where Gunnysack Joe had said it was, got a buggy whip, and dragged Gunnysack Joe from the buggy by the handcuffs he had on, and began to whip him to make him tell where the camp was. Gunnysack Joe appealed to the posse to protect him, and they protested against the whipping, and Blue stopped. All went back to town, and Gunnysack Joe was kept in the custody of one person or another. One night, not long afterwards, he was in a saloon, still in custody and handcuffed when Charlie Blue came in. Blue took off Gunnysack Joe's handcuffs and told him he was now a free man and asked him if he was glad of it. Gunnysack Joe said he was. Blue then asked if he would have a drink with him, and Gunnysack Joe said he would. Blue asked him if he was a friend of his or an enemy, and Gunnysack Joe answered, "You have treated me in such a way I cannot be a friend of yours." Blue then asked what he was going to do about it, and Gunnysack Joe answered that he did not know that he was going to do anything. Blue asked him again if he was a friend or enemy, and Gunnysack Joe answered that he was not a friend. Blue drew his pistol, and pointing it at Gunnysack Joe, worked the hammer backwards and forwards and repeated his question, and Gunnysack Joe answered, "I will have to be your friend now." Blue told him that he was a coward, and lifting his pistol again, asked him again if he was a friend. Gunnysack Joe said, "Do you want the truth? Well, Charlie, I don't like you." And Blue shot him dead. 5. Fly's right hand was crippled, and, as he walked, he held it, as almost always, in his pocket. Crossing 3rd Street, when he got within 15 feet or so of the sidewalk, he looked up and saw Sandy Weber standing at the water plug at the corner. Weber's right hand, in which he held a pistol, was also in his pocket. "Mr. Fly, I heard you have been around looking for me." And Weber began shooting. The first shot missed Fly, who threw up his right hand and started to go back. The second struck him in the neck. As he was falling headlong with his arms out, another bullet struck him. His body was close to the curb, and his face in the dust. Weber walked up calmly and, stooping, shot him in the back of the head. He walked around Fly's body once or twice and said, "Now, you son of a bitch, I suppose you will go around looking for me." And throwing back his coat, put his pistol in his pocket. He took out his handkerchief, taking his hat off, wiped his brow and the sweatband of his hat, put on his hat, and walked down 3rd Street, slowly at first, and then quickening his steps.
Social life. Pride, the foreman, and 5 others who worked under him at the ranch were on their way to a dance Christmas Eve, riding in a small wagon on the highway. All had been drinking. Pride and 2 others were on the seat in front and Green at the back, his feet hanging over the rear end of the wagon. Pride was driving. Green shot at a dog following a Mexican family going in the opposite direction, and Pride said to Green that if he didn't behave, he would have to get off and walk. After a while, Green asked Graft, sitting beside Pride, for a drink. There was a jug in the front of the wagon, in reach of Graft, and Pride told Graft not to let Green have it. Green asked again, and when Graft again refused, Green jumped off the wagon and fired from the ground. 5 or more shots in all were fired. Pride was shot in the back of the neck and then in the face. Graft halted the team and was wounded. The shots at Green went through his hat and coat sleeve. The man who had been sitting on the bottom of the wagon, leaning against Green, tried to get up when Green fired the first shot and was killed. Domestic Scenes 1. When they told her husband that she had lovers, all he said was, "One of them might have a cigar and set the barn on fire." 2. Toller was a surveyor, and his business called him away from home weeks at a time. To help Wheat locate a claim upon the public lands and give him a home until he did, Toller asked Wheat to his ranch. He was to help around the house. Wheat began to tell Mrs. Toller about her husband, how unfaithful he was to her. After a month or two, Wheat and Mrs. Toller became more than friendly. There was talk between them that she would get a divorce, and they slept together when they could. During the haymaking season, Toller was on his ranch, and the bitter feeling between husband and wife flared up because he had seen a whispered conversation between his wife and Wheat. Toller was drinking for the first time during their married life. His wife went down to the cellar and brought up a bottle of homemade wine. He finished it quickly and wanted more, went down to the cellar himself and rolled a barrel out. Mrs. Toller became afraid and took her husband's pistol from where it was hanging over the washstand in their bedroom and hid it under the head of the bed. Wheat asked her for the pistol and took it to his own room. Just before dark, Wheat went out of the house to find Toller and bring him in to supper. They came into the house together. Toller was drunk. Supper was on the table and both men sat down, but Mrs. Toller was standing. Her husband asked her why she didn't sit down and have her supper. She said she didn't want any, and he replied that since he paid for the grub, he would eat. He had a table knife in his hand and began pounding the table with the point until it was bent, cursing and saying he would cut his heart out and hang it on a pole. Wheat got up from the table and went to his room for his pistol. He was back in a few minutes, stood at the door and asked Toller if he meant him. Toller sprang up and they tussled in the next room. Mrs. Toller heard one of them fall to the floor and then a shot and heard her husband cry out, "My God, Kate, I am shot!" There were several shots after that, and Toller ran out of the house, Wheat after him. At the door, Wheat stopped and went back to his room for Toller's pistol and then went out. By this time it was dark. She found her husband lying on the ground. A bullet had entered his belly, and there were bloodstains from the house to the body. He had also been shot through the top of his head as he was sitting on the ground. Powder burns on both sides of his face, and the top of his head burnt to a crisp. 3. At the time of their marriage, Andrew was worth about $50,000. Polly had nothing. "He has gone up to the mine, and I wish to God he would fall down and break his neck. I just hate him. I just shiver when he touches me. Andy, I am going to write a letter that may seem hard-hearted. You know that I do not love you as I should, and I know that I never can. Don't you think it best to give me a divorce? If you do, I will not have to sell the house in Denver that you gave me, and I will give you back the ranch in Delta. After we are divorced, if you care for me and I care for you, we will marry again. Polly. Burglar's tools. Those drills in the right man's hands are called safe drills and used as such. This might be used for a blowpipe, for blowing gunpowder into a safe. This is a whetstone and this a watch spring. They would use the whetstone to sharpen a knife or tool. It would make a saw out of that spring. This could be used for unlocking a lock, a skeleton key for a padlock. This for blowing open a safe, and this for picking open a window sash. This would open a handcuff if in the right shape. I don't know if you could use it for anything else. This is an old key and would make a skeleton key, and this is an ordinary skeleton key. 2. He entered the store with barley sacks upon his feet and a barley sack over his head, holes cut in front through which to look, and carried a shotgun, both barrels loaded with birdshot. But the barley sack upon one of his feet caught on something at the end of the counter. The mask became displaced so that he could not see, and the gun was jerked from his hand. 6. A squeeze was going on in the Grass Creek mine. The partitions and columns left to support the roof were settling into the floor, and rock and coal were falling from the top and sides. Bill was set to clearing up the debris from the tracks and leveling the floor. Other workmen followed him, timbering to keep rock and coal from falling. After a few days, Mr. Thomas had the timbering stopped and told the workmen to help in clearing the tracks. Coal and rock were still falling beyond the timbering. And Bill said to Mr. Thomas, "This is going to fall if it isn't taken down." "It won't fall yet," said Mr. Thomas. "You have no idea how this will hang." And he added, "I can't stop to take it down now. Clear right up, boys. Hurry now and clear up, for I want to send coal out of here this evening." Bill was set to load up some coal, which cumbered the tracks beyond the timbering, and within a few minutes, a mass of coal fell upon him from the sides. 7. The shovelers, unloading a ship lying at the wharf with a cargo of coal, had worked down to the skin or floor. They had cleared a space of about 3 feet under the hatch and about 20 feet below the deck, the coal around them rising to a height of 15 feet. The two shovelers filled the tub or bucket unusually high, higher than the edge. Frenchy was one of the men to steady the tub until it cleared the hatchway, holding a line as the tub was hoisted. The engineer was signaled. The bucket cleared the hatchway, but above the hatch, it began to rock and swing. Still hoisted, the bucket swung against the mainstay, 30 feet above the deck, tilted over, and 300 or 400 pounds of coal fell out, back into the hold, and upon the head of Frenchy. Chinese. 1. "Joe Chinaman, do you know what God is?"
"I don't know what it is."
"Do you know anything about the obligations of an oath under the Christian religion?"
"I don't know what it is."
"Will you tell right if you talk to the jury now?"
"Yes, I talk some."
"What were you doing in Daisy Fiddletown's house when you worked for her in Albuquerque?"
"Cooking."
"What kind of house is it?"
"Whorehouse."
"Did she send you with her bank book and $160 in gold and silver to the First National Bank, and did you go instead to the Faro Bank at Hope's Corner and gamble her money away?"
2.
The Chinese woman in Kum Kuk Alley lay dying. "I don't know of any reason that Fong Ah Sing had for shooting me," she said in Chinese, "unless a few days ago I was bathing my feet over a room in which Fong Ah Sing was sitting and spilled a little water on the floor. It leaked through and fell upon Fong Ah Sing. He was very angry and told the owner of the house that I must apologize and make him a present to prevent bad luck coming upon the house. The owner did make some little present to Fong Ah Sing, and I thought the matter settled. 3. Johnny Cleek and Almira's husband talked about burning Lad's barn. They were in the front room and Almira in the kitchen. Only a board partition between the two rooms, and she could hear every word. There was a stack of hay on the side of the barn, and they split the fuse so that it could be lit and put the can of powder in the hay, and one of them touched a match to the fuse. Almira could see the fire. When her husband came into the house, he had his hat, coat, and shoes off, and had been running. "What did you burn that barn for?" "Keep quiet. Lad had no business hiring Chinamen." The bastard. Miss Lavender had been living in Marysville when she met Jed Wellington. She came to San Francisco when their child was about to be born, and was placed by Jed in the home of an old colored woman, a respectable Christian. Jed visited Miss Lavender often during her stay, and paid all the doctor's bills and expense, even her dentist's bill. The child was his, he said to the dentist, but he would not marry the girl, would be just to her and pay all the expense of her care, and take care of the child. The old colored woman spoke to him about Miss Lavender. "She is feeling very bad," the old woman said. "Yes, I know," said Jed. After the birth of her child, Miss Lavender left the city, and Jed left the child with the old colored woman. He did not want the mother to see the child again, because her parents might find out about their affair. In time, Miss Lavender married, and Jed Wellington was glad of that. It got her out of the scrape, and him, too. He did not want the baby dressed in calico, but wanted him dressed in white, always, kept in white, and whatever the expense, he would pay it. If the child was awake when he came, he would take him up and play and talk to him. If he was not awake, he would wait until he woke. As the boy grew older, he was dressed in a handsome black suit with a black cap and wore his hair long. Jed took the child out with him, often, would take him and the boy's nurse, the old colored woman's daughter, down to North Beach, for the little boy liked the birds and monkeys and wild animals that were kept there, and his father would bring him fruit and cakes. "This is my son, doctor. Isn't he a nice-looking boy? I think a great deal of that boy, and I'm going to raise him up and look after him and educate him and make a man of him." Jed called the boy Richard, the name of Jed's brother, then dead, who had left Jed all his money, and Jed said he hoped he might be able to raise the boy to be like the boy's uncle. When the old colored woman's daughter, the child's nurse, married and moved to Petaluma, Richard was still very young. He was taken to her home and lived with her, and was brought up with her children, and went by their family name. Richard was sent to private school when he was 10. Jed Wellington arranged for his board there and schooling, but he was placed at school as a ward of his father, not as a son. The boy was not good at his studies. When he was 15, Wellington sent him to a ranch, but Richard soon returned of his own accord to his former nurse's home in Petaluma. It was the only home he knew. He wrote to Jed Wellington for money once. Richard knew him only as a guardian taking care of him for a father and mother he did not know, and Wellington sent it. Afterwards, Jed Wellington ignored his requests. "Jed," Wellington's brother once asked, "whatever became of that boy you were taking care of?" "The boy? Oh, I tried to make something out of him, but he didn't amount to anything, and I let him go." When Richard was 20, he was a bootblack in a colored barber shop.